Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we are talking about a multinational police investigation into cybercrimes across the continent and a BBC probe into how influencers spread disinformation about women's health on social media platforms.
I was just scrolling on my For You page and an influencer came up and she said, oh, I've got the cure for PCOS. So I went onto their profile and found that they were selling supplements, workout programs, coaching. So they were kind of profiting off this idea of selling a cure, which does not exist.
It's Wednesday, the 11th of December. First, we go to Lusaka. Zambia's Constitutional Court made a ruling this week that may have far-reaching consequences, not just for the man at the center of it. It has consequences for the political landscape leading up to the next election, due in 2026, and the judiciary as well. Edgar Lungu, who first became president when Michael Sata died while in office in 2014, served for 20 months and then ran again. He won that election, and when he wanted to stand again, he was given the go-ahead by the courts. That election, he lost to current president Hakainde Hichilema. But now he's been told he can't stand again. The Constitutional Court proceedings were broadcast live across Zambia.
Final orders. Our combined interpretation, therefore, of Sections 2 and 7 of the Act and the repealed Article 35 of the Constitution is that the first respondent's term of office, that ran from 25th January 2015 to 13th September 2016, constituted a term of office. The first respondent's term, which ran from 13th September 2016 to August 2021, constituted his second term. The first respondent, Mr. Edgar Chagwalungu, has therefore been twice elected and has twice held office. Article 106(3) of the Constitution makes the first respondent ineligible to participate in any future elections as a presidential candidate.
Mr. Lungu says he will fight on, talking about going to Plan B and alleging judicial manipulation in a social media post. Let's hear what some Zambians said about the verdict.
The decision to bar Edgar Lungu from contesting the 2026 general election and future elections is completely politically driven, especially coming at a time when the current government is extremely underperforming.
Why was he allowed to stand in the first place in the last election? And then furthermore, is the judiciary compromised? And is that due to political affiliations? What could have caused them to not bar ECL from standing in 2021? What would have happened had he won in 2021? Meaning he would have basically served three terms, which is illegal according to our constitution.
It just goes to show how the executive has so much power over the judiciary. Because everybody knows that if Lungu was still president, this was not going to happen. This has only happened because HH is now president. Even when they said that they're going to stream, almost everyone knew that the outcome was going to be in the favor of the state, and which of course is that he shouldn't be able to recontest in 2026.
Our former colleague, the journalist Dingindama Jonah Buyoya, has been spelling out the political and legal implications of the ruling for us. First, how was the judgment received inside the court?
In court, I think that the larger majority of the people present were those in support of the petitioner, which is the reason why the former president has now been declared ineligible. But also to mention that this was broadcast live for the entire country for the first time that a court proceeding is broadcast for the public to consume. And the majority of the feedback has really just been from the public and mixed reaction, as you would expect for those that are supporters of the former president and those that are not. So it's really been mixed feelings after this judgment.
What does it mean for politics in Zambia? Because Edgar Lungu had won an earlier judgment that allowed him to stand, and now this one that says he can't.
It changes the dynamic of what the next election is going to look like, really, because he was the biggest contender for the 2026 election, but it also changes the future of what such a scenario means in terms of our constitution, because the Constitutional Court went back on their own ruling that they passed previously in two different cases. And so this is a new precedent that has been set and will determine a lot of future aspects of Zambia's judiciary.
Edgar Lungu said before the judgment that President Hichilema was using the provisions of the law as a political weapon against him. What did he mean by that?
Before the judgment and within the trial of the Constitutional Court determining his eligibility, three Constitutional Court judges were suspended and ultimately removed from the Constitutional Court, paving the way for new judges to be appointed. And this did not sit very well with the former president and his supporters, because they believed that this was an attempt to determine this case and the president to interfere with the judiciary. The three Concord judges that were suspended and subsequently removed are the previous judges that upheld the decision that this former president should contest in 2021. So that felt for former President Edgar Lungu and those that agreed with him that the president was interfering, because it is him who appoints and removes judges in Zambia.
So objectively speaking, though, was the president interfering, or was there good reason for those judges to be removed?
According to the Judicial Complaints Commission, the Constitutional Court judges conducted themselves improperly. And it is very difficult to assess this, because the president appointing and removing judges just simply compromises the judiciary altogether. And so it is a very difficult scenario that we find ourselves in, because the president is dealing with direct opponent. And if you look at it, it only serves one interest, and largely just his interest, if an opponent is removed from the ballot. So to a larger extent, this has never looked good on the side of the president, even if him and his government argue that this is well within the provisions of the Constitution, because it is the one that gives him the power to appoint and remove judges.
In response to the judgment that bars him from running in 2026, Edgar Lungu has said that he is going to activate Plan B. What is that? Do we know?
His party, the Patriotic Front, held a press briefing. And at the press briefing, his vice president said that come rain, come sunshine, Edgar Lungu would be on the ballot in 2026. It is unclear how they're going to do this, but early indications are that they want to seek further legal redress and would like to go ahead with petitioning that he is on the ballot in 2026. If the press briefing is anything to go by, that is what seems to be their plan B. But they have not provided any specific details as to what President Edgar Lungu said in his statement. But it was explicitly clear that they still insist that he will be on the ballot in the next election in 2026.
He was the sixth president of Zambia. He came to the position when Sata died, and he served just 20 months. He was voted out and replaced by the new president, Hichilema.
Yes, he was. He served the first 20 months after President Michael Sata died. And that term is what has brought us to where we are today, because in the current constitution, which was amended in 2016, it doesn't count as a full term of office. But in the constitution that elected Edgar Lungu, it did count as a term of office, which is why he has been declared ineligible, because in his administration, he straddled between two different constitutions, one from 1996 and one that he amended in 2016.
What I'm trying to understand is, why is he not allowed to stand? Because he didn't serve full terms.
In the 1996 constitution, before it was amended in 2016, it didn't matter how long you serve in office. As long as you've been elected twice, you could not contest a third time. But in the 2016 election, after it was amended, the constitution now states that if you serve less than 3 years of a sitting president's remaining term, that does not count as a full term. However, the ruling of the Constitutional Court today was that his first term was in the 1996 constitution, and that constitutes a full term. His second term was in the 2016 constitution, and that too constitutes a full term. In the Zambian law, a president can only serve two terms. And to that extent, he has been ruled to have served two terms and cannot contest any further elections. In fact, he was not supposed to contest the 2021 election, but because of an error in judgment by the Constitutional Court, he contested the election in 2021.
But he lost.
Yes, he did.
So that would have been that would have been a third term then, in other words, in terms of the new constitution.
Absolutely. That would have been a third term, which he is not supposed to hold.
Why is he fighting so hard, do you think?
He came back into active politics on the argument that the government of President Hage Ndihijilema has been trying hard to destroy the former ruling party, the Patriotic Front, and the legacy of former President Michael Sata. He says that this government of the UPND has launched a witch hunt against him, his supporters, and his family especially. He stands up to defend his family and defend those that served with him in government because of what they call frivolous corruption allegations that hold no water. So he stood to come back into active politics to defend these people and himself. And he says most recently that the UPND administration has failed the people of Zambia because the cost of living has gone high. The people in this country are now experiencing over 17 hours of load shedding on a daily basis. And he says that it is only him that can take things back to where they were and possibly better.
And do you think that Zambians want him back, would support him?
Some Zambians would. It seems that the tide has not really changed. The people that supported him in 2021 are even more resolved, especially that the economic situation in Zambia is in fact deteriorating. And so they have an even more reason to support him.
Dingindaba Jonah Buyoya, a journalist and television presenter at Diamond Television in Lusaka. That is the sound of how many of us work. It's also the sound of how we relax after work, because we spend many, many hours staring at computer and mobile phone screens. Criminals intent on harming us in the cyberspace do the same. They can try and hack your phone, which is like breaking into your private space, and through that, they can steal your social media identity, your bank details, your private photographs, much like having your physical possessions being stolen in a burglary. These are called cybercrimes. They do great damage, and they are on the rise. Their prevalence on the continent and the ripple effects of it across the world has given rise to a mission called Operation Serengeti, conducted in 19 African countries by the International Criminal Police Organization, Interpol for short, and also AFRIPOL, the African Union Police Agency. More than 1,000 people have been arrested between September and October this year. Their crimes have cost financial losses of nearly $200 million. Criminal networks were busted in Senegal, Cameroon, and Kenya, among other countries. We'll hear more about Operation Serengeti shortly, but first, let's listen to Vincent Ngundi, the Acting Director of Cybersecurity at the Communications Authority in Kenya. We began our conversation with him telling me just how bad cybercrime is in Kenya.
If I could just start with a bit of background, I think we started actively looking at cyber threats targeted at the country about 8 years ago. So in 2017, through various systems, we were able to detect about 7.7 million attacks targeted at our country, at the infrastructure within our country. But in the last year alone, that has grown significantly from 7.7 million in 2018 to around 3.5 billion cyber threats that we've detected.
And what do you mean when you say cyber threats? Give us an idea of the types of threats that we're talking about.
So the most prevalent is system attacks. And when we talk about system attacks, it's about cyber criminals attempting to infiltrate into computer systems through vulnerabilities in those systems. But we're also seeing a lot of cases of malware malicious software attacks, as well as brute force attacks, where criminals are trying to, you know, deliberately break into systems by using password guessing techniques. So those are the topmost attacks that we are seeing currently.
So is it just a matter of when anybody hacks your system, you know, finds your password, breaks into your WhatsApp or your computer or whatever? Are we all equally vulnerable? Are we all kind of sitting ducks for this? What is it?
I think we all are. I think all systems are vulnerable in one way or another. Obviously, it all depends on what kind of value is resident in those systems. So obviously, systems with high value information, high value applications. So for example, systems that store personal information that can be used to gain access to people's private information. Of course, financial systems, government systems, all those are high value systems. And obviously, there'll be a higher level of attack targeted at those systems because of the value of the digital assets that they contain. But essentially, all systems are vulnerable. There's no system, I would say, that is not vulnerable in the world.
So what can be done to combat all of this?
Well, there are a number of things. Obviously, the weakest link in cybersecurity is the human element. But of course, you need, one, laws that curb certain elements of cyber criminal activity. You need to develop organizational capacity to protect systems, especially critical infrastructure. But as I said, the weakest link is the human element. So there needs to be a deliberate effort to create awareness about cyber hygiene, cyber etiquette, involve the youth in the ethical use of technology. And at the same time, ensuring that, you know, the youth grow with certain values in them, whether they're national values or personal values, to ensure that you try and curb, you know, the misuse of technology. Through especially the youth.
That's Vincent Ngundi, the Acting Director of Cybersecurity at the Communications Authority of Kenya. So what prompted Operation Serengeti? Enrique Hernandez Gonzalez should know. He is the Assistant Director of Cybercrime Operations at Interpol.
The Operation Serengeti is the third edition of the large-scale regional operation that we have been organizing in Africa since 2022. Its original name was the Africa Cyber Search Operation. So the first edition was in 2022, the second one in 2023, and this year we decided to rename it as Operation Serengeti because it's a more impactful name and it's something that's more related to the region. The objective of this operation is to focus on the main threats that we had identified that are targeting the Africa region.
So which threats were they? Can you sketch for us some of the biggest ones and the most threatening, you know, the most dangerous ones?
The top three ones that we identified this year in the region were ransomware, business email compromise, and online scams. And also we decided to add digital extortion. So those were the four types of cyber threats that we decided to focus Operation Serengeti this year on.
So which countries in Africa did it target? Were they countries that had the highest rates of cybercrime on the continent?
Well, the truth is that we get inputs from all African countries. Well, not really all, because I think there are 54 countries in Africa, and we receive inputs from 50 countries in Africa in order to draft this report. So getting all these inputs from the 50 countries are the ones that, from most of them, were reported as the threats that they had identified as the ones that were more prominent this year.
So what can you tell us about how the operation was conducted?
The operational phase, it's true that only lasts 2 months, from the beginning of September till the end of October. This really starts with the Africa Cybercrime Threat Assessment Report that was published in April. So after we published this report, we organized a meeting, the one that we call Africa Working Group on Cybercrime for Heads of Unit, that was organized in Nigeria at the beginning of May. So we discussed the results of the threat assessment report with all the heads of the cybercrime units of the African countries. And we decide to propose to them to begin this Operation Serengeti, focusing on these top threats that we have identified on the report. So once that it's agreed with the member countries, in May, our analysts start to work on information. They start to retrieve intelligence with the assistance of our private partners. And we start to provide that intelligence to member countries so they can start to work on that information that we are providing, and they can start to research. And during the next 2 months, they start to conduct their operations, they start to arrest people, they start to take down infrastructures. So it's 6 months working with Operation Serengeti.
And you arrested 1,006 suspects during the operational phase of the operation, and you clamped down on cybercrime that left tens of thousands of victims. Just tell us a little bit about how people were affected by the crimes that you arrested these individuals for.
We saw a little bit of everything. It was mainly online scams, Ponzi schemes. We identified false investment pages. We identified fake virtual casinos. So it was mainly a lot of different ways that criminals were using to scam people and get the money from African citizens.
I believe that you also found victims, people who had been trafficked. Tell us about that, the most impactful cases around trafficking, because it's a huge problem around the world.
It's true that in some countries we identify these cases where people are lured with this fake advertisement, work advertisement. In this case, I think that the most relevant one were in Cameroon. So we identified that these people were being dragged into Cameroon with this fake advertisement. And when they were there in Cameroon, what usually happens, and that's something we have seen also very often in the southeast of Asia, they were forced to work in these, let's say, call centers or cyber scam compounds to call other people and to scam them, to force them to invest their money in fake products that didn't exist. In this case, for us, it's a major success because it's not only obviously preventing this kind of scams to continue. It's also about releasing, about freeing these people that were victims of human trafficking. So it's a big success, not only from the cybercrime perspective, but also from the human trafficking one.
Tell us about the people that were arrested, more than 1,000 of them. Did it target politically connected cyber criminals or just small fish?
It was a little bit of everything. Without knowing all the details, it's true that with the cases that were shared by member countries with us, there were small criminals, because there are always small criminals that start their scams and try to lure as many people as possible. But there were also more complex organizations. There were also organizations that, let's say, have some cells in the African countries, but we know they belong to larger organizations that are also based in other regions. For example, we had this case in Senegal. They arrested Chinese people that were running this Ponzi scheme. And we've seen that this is a modus operandi that is happening in other countries, in other regions. And it's because the, let's say, main criminals are based in another region, but they are starting to send cells to other countries. Now they are also acting there in Africa in order to expand their business and try to also get more money from more countries.
What makes it difficult to fight cybercrime?
The main problem, I think, when we fight cybercrime is that it's a crime that it's really global. It's one of those type of crimes that it's very difficult to find a criminal organization that is only based in one country. Because if maybe the criminals are based in that country, it's very often to find victims in another country, to find bank accounts in a third country, to find victims in several countries. So you really need international cooperation in order to investigate cybercrime, in order to put everything together, to get the global picture and to be able to effectively investigate cybercrime. So that's more or less what the gap that we are trying to close in Interpol, connecting member countries, not only within the African region, that's, for example, what we do in Operation Serengeti, but also when we need cooperation between different regions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enrique Hernandez-Gonzalez, Assistant Director of Cybercrime Operations at Interpol. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Let's talk about influencers. And let's talk about TikTok. The two things came to the attention of my colleague Jackie Wakefield recently when she scrolled into information being pumped out on the platform by people claiming to have cures for chronic health conditions affecting young women. Jackie found that more than 50% of so-called health influencers talking about polycystic ovarian syndrome and endometriosis are spreading disinformation about these conditions. It affects many young women, and because these women are often dismissed or ignored by the medical profession, they turn to social media platforms for help. But many of the so-called health influencers have financial incentives to disseminate their solutions to these problems. In the course of her investigation, Jackie spoke to women from the UK, Kenya, Nigeria, South Africa, Brazil, Australia, and the US. She told me how she came across the health influencers peddling cures for cash for PCOS. First, what is polycystic ovarian syndrome?
PCOS stands for polycystic ovary syndrome. It's a hormonal condition and it impacts about 10% of women around the world. So it's really, really common. And it comes with a variety of symptoms. There's really no one size fits all. So some symptoms can include fatigue, depression, weight gain, hair growth.
Heavy periods,
painful periods, and sometimes difficulties getting pregnant as well.
So how did you start investigating this? Because then it led you to PCOS influencers. Now, we thought we'd heard the last of the influencers. This is a new level, right?
Exactly. I mean, I just came across it myself because I'm a little bit addicted to TikTok. And I was just scrolling on my For You page and an influencer came up and she said, oh, I've got the cure for PCOS. And I knew a little bit about PCOS just because some of my friends have it. And I thought, there is no cure for PCOS. So what is this influencer actually talking about? So I went onto their profile and found that they were selling supplements, workout programs, coaching. So they were kind of profiting off this idea of selling a cure, which does not exist.
But how do we know it doesn't exist? How did you know it doesn't exist?
So a lot of my friends have PCOS, how I knew at the time. But since then, I've now spoken to a lot of experts who've studied PCOS their whole careers. And unfortunately, they just don't know what a cure is at this stage. There's ways to manage the symptoms of PCOS, but there is no cure.
Okay. We'll go into how women and the medical conditions that they bring to the medical profession get treated shortly, because I think that's part of what your investigation looks at as well, the broader issues, right? But so let's talk about this influencer. They're saying there was a cure. Then you got curious. You went out and you spoke to women who do have PCOS. What did they tell you?
Yeah, exactly. So I spoke to around 14 women around the world who have PCOS, who had experienced firsthand and navigating the information out there around PCOS. So, yeah, a lot of them had struggled to get treatment through medical systems, through their doctors. So they went online, they went to TikTok, Instagram, whatever, and they saw these influencers who had PCOS and were telling them, I've cured my PCOS, I've lost weight, I've managed my symptoms, I've reversed everything. Here's what you can do. So what we did then is we looked at the top 100 videos on TikTok and Instagram and found that more than half of them were selling a fake cure or spreading misinformation for
polycystic
PCOS.
Ovarian syndrome.
Yeah, so they had a financial incentive to spread misinformation around a cure. So we spoke to women and they'd spent thousands of dollars on supplements, pills, workout programs. A lot of them had followed influencer diet plans, which created quite a negative relationship with their body. A lot of the diet plans sold on TikTok and Instagram are really restrictive. And then a lot of the women felt a sense of shame because it hadn't worked for them and they'd been told it would.
So most of them said they had polycystic ovarian syndrome, diagnosed, I imagine. So the women who came, who followed these influencers, these polycystic ovarian syndrome influencers, how many of them reported from the ones that you spoke to or from the evidence that you saw as well, you know, on TikTok, said that it had actually worked for them? And how many percentage-wise, would you say, said, well, it didn't work for me?
So the women I spoke to, none of them had experienced really any benefits from the influencer programs. That's not to say that that's everyone. I only spoke to 14 women. This affects 10% of women around the world. But I did speak to experts within the PCOS kind of expertise and gynecologists and people whose job it is to work with women with PCOS. And some diet plans work for women. Weight management can help with PCOS symptoms. So it's not to say it doesn't work for everyone. And of course, there is the placebo effect. So you could take some supplements and really feel it's working and it could be working. But sometimes that just happens from taking any pill. But there really is no evidence behind most supplements for PCOS. There is some early evidence for one, but it's really not there to kind of tell.
So what stood out most for you about the experiences that the women shared with you?
I think there were two things that really stood out. So first off was the fact that these women were really ready to try anything. They'd felt quite let down by their GPs or the medical system generally, and were willing to pay so much money and spend so much time trying really anything that influencers or anyone online was recommending. And then the other thing that struck me was their sense of shame when it didn't work, and the fact that they blamed themselves for the fact that these influencer fake cures for polycystic ovary syndrome weren't working.
Do you think that the reason why this space existed for influencers to step into a very serious medical condition for women is because formal medicine doesn't seem to have the answers, doesn't have a cure, doesn't seem to have a way of addressing it?
I think that's definitely part of it, because many of the women I spoke to, particularly in Kenya, Nigeria, said like they'd been to a GP, they'd been diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome, and what they were told was, you can go on birth control and come back when you're pregnant, and that's all, or come back when you want to get pregnant, and that's all we can do for you. But these women have real pain and real symptoms that affects their life every single day. It's not good enough to just come back when they want to get pregnant.
That's, and to take some medication that they don't necessarily need, because the birth control has its own set of conditions as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and like birth control can be a really good management tool.
That was the BBC's Jackie Wakefield. Focus on Africa was produced by Victor Silva and Yvette Twagira Maria here in London. Charles Kidonga was working in Nairobi. Paul Bart Jibinga was the senior producer. Nick Rundell, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. Don't forget, you can find us on air, online, and on YouTube. Our sister podcast, Africa Daily, in its next edition, will be looking at the expansion of the economic grouping BRICS, now with Ethiopia and Egypt becoming members. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.